My name is Kate Sawada. Today's date is May 27th, 2010. I'm interviewing Helm Roberts about his military experience and the Kentucky Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Why don't we just start with you telling me a little bit about where you're from? And
okay, I grew up, I was born in Huntington, West Virginia, August 26, 1931. And we moved to Kentucky when I was 3 years old. My dad grew up in Shelbyville, Kentucky, and he found work after World War I in Huntington, West Virginia, with San Antonio Railroad. So anyway, we moved. I was born in Huntington when he was working there, and then they transferred him to the Russell division there. And he was a storekeeper on the railroad, and he bought all the parts for railroad cars and repairs and things like that. I went to all of my schooling. My primary and secondary education was at Russell High School. I graduated in 1949 as valedictorian of that class. And then I had no hope of going to college. We didn't have the money. I was the fourth child in the family, and nobody else had gone to college. And so, are all those noises going to be a problem? Okay, I'm trying to think where I was. I was
talking about your dad. Going to college because you didn't.
Right. We didn't have any money, but my cousin who lives in Shelbyville, Tom Marshall, he had gone to Princeton on an NROTC scholarship, and he sent me all the papers. Nobody, even though I was valedictorian, nobody offered any scholarships of any kind at that time. So I was planning to be a machinist on the railroad and take out an apprenticeship. And my cousin sent me the papers to take the NROTC test. I passed the test and went to Miami University. And I'd never met an architect, but I decided that that would be a neat profession. I'd read a book called Tomorrow's House in our library. I think I may still have it. It's a little overdue. But anyway, that made me decide to go to architecture school. And then I went to Miami University, and at the end of 5 years, I was commissioned as an officer in the Navy. We did 3 midshipman cruises. The first one was to Hawaii. In 1950, that was the start of the Korean War. One of the ships in our task force went on to Korea after we stopped in Hawaii. And we went back, instead of doing our gunnery exercises, we had to unload all of our ammunition, and they put a helicopter deck on the ship while we were hanging around waiting for the cruise to end. The second cruise was in Little Creek, Virginia, in Pensacola, where the Navy exposes you to naval aviation and also to the, at that time they called it UDT, but underwater demolition training. They didn't have Navy SEALs at that point, which was, I was considering that because I loved to swim underwater. And the third cruise between our junior and senior year was to France on the battleship New Jersey. And we were the senior officers at that time, senior midshipmen. And we got to boss around all the freshmen. So, but we went to France and made a trip to Paris and Mont Saint-Michel and a bunch of other places, and Portugal too, Lisbon, Portugal. Went into the Navy. I went to Pensacola. The Navy obligated you to stay for 2 years after you got your education. The Korean War came up, and they extended everybody's obligation to 3 years. So I thought, well, it doesn't take that long to go through flight school, so I applied for naval aviation and got in. very luckily, because I found out on my second Navy physical, after they'd already had 2 years of investment in me as a student, that I was colorblind. And the first test, just by the grace of God, they didn't show me the plates that I couldn't read. I read everything that they asked me to. They didn't give me the full battery of, there's 20 sheets in this Ishikawa test. And the next year they said, oh, that doesn't change, and my physical, they didn't check it. Well, the third year, I missed one of the plates, and the guy made me take the whole test, and they were about to boot me out of the Navy because of colorblindness. And I went to the library and read everything I could on colorblindness. I could see colors and did watercolors and color drawings and everything, but I had no idea that there was any weakness there. So I found a book called by Dr. Eldridge Dash Green, who was an expert on colorblindness, and it described a test that he gave called the Eldridge Green Lamp Test. And the Navy allowed me to take that test in order to see if I could pass the colorblind requirement. As it turns out, you can't cheat on the test.
No.
But it's really helpful to know that there's only four colors in it. There's white, amber, green, and red. And it simulates what lights would look like through fog or at a distance. They use neutral density filters to simulate the fog and apertures, different apertures for the distance. And you can say with great confidence, you know, that's green, and that's red, and that's amber. But I knew there wasn't any blue in there, and there were no other colors in there. So I think that it probably helped me pass the test. Well, once that got in my medical record, they never asked me to take the test again. And I even got into flight school, which has the same requirement. So just luckily, if they had shown me the whole book the first time around, I'd never gotten in the Navy. But anyway, I graduated, and I had to extend a year. The architecture, they paid for 4 years of college. Navy pays tuition, books, and fees. Incidentally, our son, Bruce, went to Duke University on the same program. Okay. He spent 7 years in the Navy as a Navy SEAL. But anyway, I had to work for my fifth year. Didn't have any support there, but they gave me a leave of absence for a year. And then I went into the Navy in 1954 and was commissioned an ensign. And went directly to flight school in Pensacola, and got my wings in August of 57, no, August of 55, and went into a squadron at Jacksonville, Florida, a Navy carrier attack squadron. And anyway, we were training our primary mission in the Navy. I flew a plane. It was one of the last propeller-driven planes in anybody's Air Force, but it would do something that the jets couldn't do at that time. They didn't have air-to-air refueling, and we had a range of about 3,000 miles without refueling, which none of the jets could do. They couldn't even come close to that. So, but our primary mission, the plane was originally designed as a close air support plane to support ground troops. Dive bomber, torpedo bomber. It would carry as much as a World War II B-17. I've carried on one demonstration as much as 8,000 pounds. We did a demo for Ike at the Bermuda. He had a Bermuda conference with McMillan, and that I happened to draw that event, the maximum load event. But we were showing him Navy air power anyway. But anyway, our primary mission was nuclear weapons delivery. And we were being trained to deliver nuclear weapons, a very efficient system, one plane, one man, one bomb. We could fly 1,500 miles from the carrier deliver the weapon and return to the carrier. It's about a 14-hour flight. We were slow. We were low and slow, as they said, flying right over the treetops to avoid radar. I got out of the Navy in August of 1957. What else? I guess that was, and then went to work in Jacksonville, Florida, where we were living at the time. We're an architecture firm, and worked there for a year. A lot of my classmates at the Miami University had gone into planning. There was a remarkable professor. I was very fortunate to have two professors who were refugees from the Holocaust. One of them was Victor Firth, who was a Czechoslovakian from Prague. He was a typical bohemian, did beautiful watercolors, and was a romantic, you might say. The other was a Prussian Jew named Rudolf Frankel, who he told me after we got out of school, they'd set up a master's program in city design. And some of my friends had taken the course and had good jobs while I was making $1.25 an hour as an architectural draftsman. And I thought, well, I need to get a better education. So I applied to school and got in. And one of the interesting things about Professor Frankel was that, and he told me this when he was one evening, or I guess it was after I got my degree there as a Master of City Design degree, and we went on some consulting trips together trying to get some work. We never got any work, but we spent some time on the road and making presentations. But one evening he was telling me that Albert Speer came to him and said, as a friend, he grew up in Germany. He was kind of the boy wonder of German architecture after World War I. Won a big competition when he was still in his early 20s. But Speer said, Rudy, as a friend, I have to tell you there's really no place for you in Germany, because he was Jewish. Mm-hmm. So Rudy took him at his word, and they went on vacation to Romania, and he didn't tell his wife, Eva, until they crossed the border that they would never go back to Germany. This was 1933. Talk about planning ahead. He knew he could see what was coming because, I guess, of all the propaganda that the Nazis had put out about Jews. So he went to Romania for 3 years and then went to England, and during the World War II, he was rebuilding factories that the Germans had bombed, and he was also a spotter for during the Blitz, you know, to show where the fires were and all of that. And he was also practicing architecture. And before he was 50 years old, he had been selected as a fellow in the Royal Institute of British Architects. Well, he came over to this country expecting to set the world on fire like his colleagues, Gropius and Mendelssohn and Mies van der Rohe and all of those. He considered himself, you know, those were the young guys. But anyway, he was just not the type to fit into the American system, and he took a job at Miami University as a professor, which is a highly respected profession in Germany. Mm-hmm. And I was just fortunate enough to have my fifth year of college and my master's degree under his with him as a mentor. He was he was one of the few people that could talk design in a tangible way, so that you could understand it. And he explained it to me one night when I was in college. I told him how frustrating it was to, you know, come up with a design and the professors say, well, you know, it doesn't quite have it, in quotes, or it needs, quote, something, unquote. But they couldn't tell you what it was or what something was. Well, Rudy, being Anyway, he explained to me, he says, well, Hal, let me tell you. He says, before we had contemporary design, we had a rule book. And then we threw out the rule book. And anyway, and the only way you know what's good and bad is from your own experience. And he says, frankly, none of these professors have ever had any experience.
Oh.
So it turned on the light for me, and I didn't feel bad about flunking some problems in my fourth year. So I almost got out of architecture because of that. I had finally learned the system and learned what pleased all the professors by the time I was a junior, and then I started flunking problems. They changed the faculty, mm-hmm. and what I was doing previously wasn't their taste, I guess. Anyway, that brings us up to the. I went into the. This was after I got out of the Navy. Navy experience. The only thing that really happened is our squadron. We were fully trained at a point in time, but they delayed our cruise for 6 months for some reason. And we put on an air show, I think, for Veterans Day with all of the planes, you know, and doing dive bombing and loft bombing and so forth at Jacksonville. And they decided that it would be nice to take VIPs out on the carrier and show them Navy air power. And so we did four of those events. But anyway, before we were about to deploy, we went down to Guantanamo and we finished up our qualifications. And the Suez Crisis came up. This was when the British and the French invaded Suez Canal, and nobody knew what was going to happen. Very tense time. This was 1956, in the fall of 1956. So they loaded up our squadron and sent us over to the Azores, where we just kind of hung around waiting to see what was going to happen. We were loaded for bear. We had all of our nuclear weapons and everything. They offloaded. We weren't sure if World War III was going to break out at the time. We didn't know who we were going to fight. Didn't know whether we were going to fight the British, the French, or the Egyptians. So, but anyway, the crisis cooled off, and we came home before Christmas. We were over there for about 2-3 months, just waiting for something to happen. Anyway, I got out of the Navy in 1957, and let's see, we need to get up to the memorial pretty quick.
Yeah,
we're going to run out of
time.
Okay.
When you were in Guantanamo, waiting with the Suez Crisis breaking out, what was it like? I mean, what did you guys do to buy the
time? We were just training. We doing night dive bombing and carrier qualifications, doing night carrier qualifications.
Okay, so you
and we were just down there to train for the mission.
Did you have
incidentally, the field we were working out of is now the Guantanamo Prisoner Center.
Oh,
it's
really?
Full of tents and everything. It was a small airfield on the main part of the base that only had a 5,000-foot runway, and they just converted it into, with tents and everything, to the prison that's there now. Anyway, it's called McCullough Field. After I got out of the Navy, I went as an architect, and then we've gone through the master's program in city design. My next job was with Ladislaus Sigo. He was one of the grand old men of the planning profession. He has been credited with inventing the consulting planning profession. He has the gold medal of the American Institute of Planners. And he had a very small office in Cincinnati, and I was fortunate enough to, I consider him one of my mentors along with Rudy Frankel, mm-hmm. As far as city planning is concerned. So I worked for him for 2 years, and we did work all over the, well, this region. That doesn't relate to the memorial, but then after Seago's office, I decided I wanted to go to California and be a, I thought there was some mystique about a California architect's license. And so we went out to Los Angeles with no job. We had some encouraging letters, but no job. We loaded all of our gear in a trailer, and including a piano. And my wife's a singer and a musician.
Okay.
So we took the piano with us. It was a little spinning, but anyway, we went to Los Angeles. I finally got a job after a couple of weeks with a firm called Victor Gruen, who is the inventor of the shopping mall. He did the first big shopping mall in Detroit, Northland. He did the first enclosed mall in Minneapolis.
I'm from Minneapolis.
Oh, we did. Is it Southland or South something?
Yeah, Southdale.
Southdale, that's yeah. It. He also did the first urban mall in Rochester, New York. In fact, that was going on while I was working there in the office. They were doing all the presentations and everything for the Rochester. They blocked off streets, built new buildings, rehabbed buildings, and made an urban, enclosed urban mall out of it. Anyway, we were out there for about a year, and we went out to the, in Hollywood, they've got a place that sells all the newspapers from all over the country because there's a lot of tourists there.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked up a copy of the Courier Journal, and we'd been looking for a house, and everything we looked at had the unheard of prices of $40,000 or $50,000, you know. These were in Beverly Hills and West Los Angeles. Looking back, that would have been the best buy we ever made. But
yeah.
I had been working a lot of overtime with Gruen. We did a job in Sydney, Australia. We did a job in Fremont, California, which at that time was a new town. We did the downtown for that. And we did a job in Aspen, Colorado. So I was very busy. It was a good job. But anyway, we looked at the Courier Journal, and the same house we were looking at for $30,000 was $15,000. This is just a normal three-bedroom, two-bath ranched house, 1962. One of the reasons we moved back to Lexington, so we decided that we'd been out in California long enough, and as a former nuclear weapons pilot, nuclear war was real to me. I knew that this wasn't some unthinkable problem. And so we moved to Lexington. I had better offers. I could have gone to work again for Seago. Looking back, it would have been a good job because he died. I would have eventually inherited the office, but it didn't happen. Anyway, we moved to Lexington. I worked for Scruggs and Hammond. And the reason was is I figured nobody would drop a bomb on Lexington on purpose. It was just the time. To put it in context, and the tension in the world, the U-2 crisis happened while we were in Cincinnati. That was a very tense period. And then a month after we came back to Lexington, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, which I was absolutely sure was the beginning of World War III. If Khrushchev hadn't pulled back on his missiles, could have happened. We could have sunk one of his boats, and who knows where it would have gone from there. So anyway, I worked for a year for Scruggs and Hammond doing urban renewal work, and then opened my own office in 1963. and I've been working as a ever since then, pretty much, except for about 10 years where I had to close the office. I worked for Howard K. Bell for 2 years, a little over 2 years. I worked for CMW for a little over 2 years, and I worked with GRW engineers as the head of their planning department. But anyway, the rest of the time I've had an office of my own, really from 1983 on. When I left CMW, I've had a one-man office working with computer. I had to learn the computer in order to design the memorial. In 1987, we'll get to the memorial there, there was a competition for the memorial, and they had picked a site near the Capitol building, and I had no... I didn't get involved in it at that point. And then, as I understand it, they couldn't agree on a site near the Capitol building. So they found this site over by the Library and Archives. Anyway, they came out with a different site and a set of conditions, you know, the rules for the memorial. It was a blind competition. Nobody was to know who designed any of the projects. I understand they had something like 40 entries from all over the country, and they said even had one from France. And as I understand it, we had to submit a model of the project, what our proposal was. This is another leading up to that point. I was brainstorming with our younger son, John, who was about to go off to the Peace Corps in Nepal. And 14 years earlier, I had designed a sundial for Woodland Park in Lexington. Mm-hmm. What had happened is there was an auditorium there where they used to have prize fights and, I guess, concerts and everything. It had burned down, and the site just sat there as a scar in Woodland Park for several years. And the parks director, Fred Henson, he says, Helms says, could you come up with some ideas on what we can do with this corner here that looks so bad? So I came up with the idea of a large sundial that was big enough to, so you could see the shadow move. And the inspiration for that came from the Smithsonian. In the Smithsonian, they have a Foucault pendulum that swings across the floor of the rotunda, and they have these wooden pins set up. And as the earth rotates, the pendulum is stable, and it knocks the pins down one by one. So it shows the rotation of the earth. Well, this was going to serve the same function. It would be just a sculpture of interest in that place, and also maybe a learning tool for children, like the one in Washington. So anyway... I was discussing the competition with our son, John, and I said, you know, I bet I could get that old sundial to touch every man's name on the day he was killed. Because I knew from the previous competition that you could isolate specific points on the... The reason it didn't get built was it went over the budget. It cost $250,000 back in 14 from 87, whatever that is. I knew that you could, and I had in mind, you know, the date that Lexington was founded and 4th of July, so that the shadow would point to those days, and Armistice Day, and that 11 minutes after 11 on the 11th day of November, which I did incorporate in the sundial there. here in Frankfort. So anyway, he said, well, Dad, I'd go for it. And so what I did is I took the Gnomon out of the old model that I had and put it in a new base that was appropriate for the, with all the names and everything in it, and not just a sundial. And you had to submit a model as a part of the competition. Again, they didn't know who was submitting what, so everybody had to submit a model. And as I understand it, it won the competition unanimously. So I got a call. Actually, I was in Washington when my wife got the call, and they told her that I'd won the competition, and she didn't say anything. And the next morning, I got a call from Jim Halvaches, and he says, Helmy, we've selected your design for the memorial. And I says, but will this thing really work? And I said, oh, sure. But I had no idea how difficult it was going to be. I was past 50 at that time, and I had done the original calculations for the sundial using a slide rule mm-hmm. and a formula. And just a formula that I got out of graphic standards, which every architect uses. And I had just gotten into computers and was working with a program called AutoCAD, which lets you, for all practical purposes, the precision is perfect. It carries everything out to 14 significant figures. The way I explain it to people, if you were in Los Angeles, it could tell you the distance between the back of a coat of paint and the front of a coat of paint, and if you subtracted them, you'd get the thickness of the coat of paint. So it will measure things more precisely than you can build them, by far. So I had to learn AutoCAD, and anyway, that's the one of the things that happened on the memorial. And they had an original budget of $350,000. Well, I had hired as a consultant Gary White, who is a very well respected contractor. He's retired now, like I am. But I figured he would know about cost, and nobody had ever done anything like the memorial before. I hadn't. And so I thought he would be a good guy to have on my team. Well, he says, Helm, this thing, the budget was $350,000. He says, this thing's going to cost two or three times that, if you're lucky. And so I called up Jim Halvaches, and I said, we're going to have to scale back the memorial because, according to Gary, this thing is going to cost a lot more than you've got to spend. And Jim Halvaches, without consulting the board, said, this is what we approved. This is, we'll find the money. Mm-hmm. And they got a little, we did the, going through the thing, the first project on the memorial was the Gnomon, or the pointer. And it was dedicated, it was built and dedicated the summer of 1987, dedicated by Martha Lane Collins on November the 11th of 1987, I believe it was. Were looking for something to unveil it with, and somebody suggested a cargo chute from the military, and that's what they used, a cargo parachute. But we placed it higher on the hill in the same orientation as the final location, along with the flagpoles, and it sat there up on the hill while we were building the memorial the next year. The first thing we did was come up with a design for the plaza, and it was a little bit different from the design that I submitted, but it's a lot simpler, which is good. Then we tried to find some granite suppliers to anyway, we came up with the dimensions and all of the rough number of slabs, and we got three people, three companies to bid the granite. This was before we ever had a general contractor. We didn't know who was going to build the project. But we needed to get the granite cut and the names carved in. We knew we could go ahead with that, like we had the Nauman. So it's really, there was three operations. The Nauman was the first one, the granite was the second one, and the construction was the last. I lost my train of thought. Anyway, we sent it out to the granite people, and we ended up, we put it out to bids, and I won't get into some of the infighting because it might embarrass some people, but anyway, we ended up using Elberton Granite Finishing Corporation out of Elberton, Georgia. Elberton is probably the biggest supplier of gravestones of any area in the country. Mm. That's their specialty. There's 40 or 50 companies that make headstones and things for cemeteries. I hadn't even considered Elberton. I'd sent the plans to Cold Spring Granite and also to Rock of Ages Granite in Vermont. Cold Spring is in Minnesota, but they had a nice granite in California that looked good. And I got this call from Elberton, a guy named Joe Finley, saying, well, you've got to use our stone. And so we put him on the list. And anyway, we put the granite out for bids, and Elberton came in. The low bidder was Cold Springs. The next low bidder was Elberton, and the highest bidder was Rock of Ages. The general looked at everything and they said, well, I don't see that much difference in the granites. Let's see if we can get them to make a contribution, an in-kind contribution. And it had been a fair bidding process, and as an architect, you don't throw a curve after you open the bids. And I said, well, you're going to have to tell them or ask for the money. I'm not going to do it. And so they did. And Elberton dropped their price low enough to get the job. They bid, I think it was $190,000 for all of that, for 220 tons of granite. It was
wow.
All cut to size with the names on it and everything. And they did a good job. Let's see, where are we? Okay, so we got a granite contractor, and I started doing drawings for the slabs. Came up with the final design. And one of the things that happened is after we had started the drawings and sending them in to have the granite slabs cut, this was in the fall of 1987, I went out to the memorial with a half inch to the foot model and lined it up pointing north, and I said, okay, let's see how she works. And I'd made it to exact scale, and I found out that the shadow was falling a scale 6 inches short of the where it should be. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh boy, what's happened? And so in order to see if it was just the model, which is very small scale compared to a real, I did a full scale mock-up of the Nauman in my backyard here in downtown Lexington. and found out that was true. The shadow was falling 6 inches short. And I thought, then I got to figuring what had happened to make the calculations off. Speaking of calculations, when I first got the job, I went to the University of Kentucky Astronomy Department, and I asked them if they'd be interested in helping me with the calculations. I needed to know where the sun lines were. They weren't interested.
Really?
And so I just happened to see, and I think accident, you never know why things happen, but I was reading through some literature and found there was this little $5 3.5-inch disc that was supposed to have everything I needed, plus two other programs, and I ordered all three of them. And I looked at one called AceCalc, which again was a $5 disc, and it seemed to do everything that I wanted it to do. It would give me the altitude or the height above the horizon and the azimuth or the direction of the sun was for anywhere, anytime, any date. And so in order to create the sun lines, I had to build a database for a given day. I had to take it at different times of the day. You plug in the location and it would give me those two numbers that I could use on the computer. And that's how the sun lines were created. And it was a shareware, what they call a shareware program, which means if you use it, you pay for it. If you can't use it, you don't pay for it. Well, I tried to find the author of the program whose name was in the software, sent him a check for his $25 because I was using the program. And I have never been able to contact him. The check was never cashed. And I don't know if he ever got the check or even knows that his program helped design that memorial. Anyway, that's an aside.
So the difference is with the 6 inches, you said?
Oh, 6 inches. Okay, good. So what happened? I thought, well, I need to have somebody verify if these calculations from this $5 program are good. So I called up the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, and I said, I need to get you to check some calculations for specific times and dates and locations. And I said, could you do that? And how much would it cost? And they said, oh, we do that all the time. Well, 2 weeks later, I got a stack of a printout give me all the exactly what I needed with every in the meantime, I had already done the calculation, which involved something like 3,000 individual sightings.
How long did that take you?
And it just went on and on and on, and I put it in I was using an old, none of the software that I used is even, nobody knows what it is now. For a spreadsheet, I was using one called SuperCalc. For typing and correspondence, I was using WordStar. And for the database, I was using something called RBase. And none of those exist now. Everything's been taken over by Microsoft Office.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about software is that every software had its own way of doing it, whether you save a file or edit a file, everything. Nobody had the same look or feel. That's one nice thing about Windows. Anyway, the reason that the shadow fell short, I had done all of my calculations for 1988, which was the year that the memorial was going to be dedicated. I was doing my observations in 1987, which is the leap year. That's the year that the leap year cycle jumps back, and so it was off about 2 inches because of the leap year cycle. And the other reason was what I called it's the penumbra effect. The sun is not a point source, so that the shadow you get, and I was doing all of my observations in November where the shadow is very long, almost at the winter solstice point. And it's real fuzzy. And so the real point of the shadow is out in the fuzz, and it looks like the shadow's falling short of that. So what I had to do is to revise all of my calculations. I adjust them by half a degree in order to get the shadow to fall in the right place. And they were already cutting granite at the time with names and everything. And as it turns out, there's a lot of tolerance. The sun or the shadow may stay, the names are about 18 inches long on average. And so it may stay on one name for several days. So if it varies 2 or 3 inches, it still works.
Okay.
And it wouldn't, I did adjust the ones that that were particularly out in the fall and in the close to the winter solstice line. But it didn't matter as you got closer in, because actually near the summer solstice line, the sun stays on name sometimes as much as a month on the same name. You can go and it'll touch that name for a month straight because it just doesn't move much during the summer months. Very slow down there at the summer solstice. So anyway, we got that, at least that resolved that problem. The another thing that entered into the design was the fact most people don't realize that all of those stones are not set in mortar like you'd think, or on concrete. They're supported on almost 800 piers. There's a crawl space underneath. You can crawl back underneath the memorial all the way back to the far corner. And the reason for that was that, first of all, if you use mortar, then water gets trapped in the mortar joints, no matter how good a mortar joint you've got. And the freeze-thaw cycle, it'll absorb water and then it expands. And even granite can't take that kind of stress. And it would have, you've seen it on concrete sidewalks where the concrete just splits off. We needed a way for, we didn't want to, since the plaza had to be dead flat. Normally you slope everything to the ground. Well, what this means is that with the open joints, every joint is a drain. So the water drains off immediately from the plaza, even in the worst thunderstorm. I've been out there in the summer. Maybe we ought to... anyway, the all that we started setting slabs, I believe, in July. And we had everything... our deadline was November the 11th of 1988 to get everything done. And we made our deadline. It was a real frantic push toward the end. One interesting thing that happened, we ran out of money in midsummer of 88, and we didn't know where the money was. We didn't know how we were going to finish up the walks and the railings. And three of the board members had gotten appraisals on their homes and were going to take out second mortgages to raise $200,000 to finish it up. And Jim Halvachis got a call from a lawyer saying that this anonymous donor had... deposited so many shares of stock to the memorial fund, and he had to come in and sign the accepting it. And he said, well, what does this mean? He said, well, it means you're $493,000 richer today. So they not only had enough money to finish the memorial, they've got enough money, and they've invested it well to maintain it. And I don't know, sure what they're going to do with it, but they've talked about scholarship funds for veterans, children, and so forth. But they've got plenty of money to maintain it. For the 10th anniversary, we replaced the gnomon. Let's talk about the dedication. Dedication was the, they had agreed that we dedicated on November the 11th, 88, and the official dedication was on that date. It was a very dreary day, and just the members of the board and a few people were there. The public dedication was the following day on the 12th, and Wallace Wilkinson was governor at that time, and he did. They had a helicopter fly over. They think they had 3 Kentucky Medal of Honor winners at the dedication, a 21-gun salute for the veterans. It was quite an affair. They had over 7,000 people at the dedication. Largest crowd probably that has ever been there. And since that time, incidentally, in the material I'm going to turn over, I've got some of the news videos and things that were done. And I've got a lot of things that have been written about the memorial by other people. Since that time, on the 5th anniversary, never forget that one, it was rainy and cold. I took a client out there, and he couldn't stay to finish the dedication. It was so cold, he said, I got to get out of here. Anyway, for the 10th anniversary, on the gnomon, stainless steel is very difficult to work with. And we didn't get the best job that we might have with the original contractor who did the gnomon, but we went ahead and used it in spite of the fact that it wasn't as good as we'd like. For the 10th anniversary, the board asked me, says, Helm, said, what do we need to do in order to get ready for this? And I said, well, you know, nobody on this board or none of the veterans have ever criticized the quality of the gnomon, but little children will tell you the truth. And they'll ask questions like, why is it crooked? And I have to tell them that the guy who built it just didn't do a very good job. Mm-hmm. And so they paid for a new gnomon for the 10th anniversary. It was done by a sculptor, artist, professional stainless steel welder from Springfield, Oregon, named Art Cady. And we've become good friends. It's his pride and joy, to the extent that about 4 years ago, he and his brother spent a week of their time along with me polishing it to a mirror finish. he'd recommended a mirror finish, and I told him we wanted a satin finish because I didn't think that would, in other words, it would stand the wear and tear better than than a mirror finish. But anyway, they came in and we spent a week polishing it up, and it's still holding up very well. For the 10th anniversary, we actually had 2 men from Belgium who came to the ceremony, and they brought to America a certificate of appreciation from some small Belgian town that Americans had helped after World War I, and this was a big deal with them. And they, they presented it to the board, or the certificate to the board. And then the other thing is, we actually had a World War I veteran there. He was in his late 90s, and he spoke. He was still able to speak to the group. So that was an interesting anniversary. We had the 20th anniversary 2 years ago. That was, I think, pretty unremarkable, although we did replace 2 slabs for the 20th anniversary. I think for the 10th anniversary, we replaced 3 slabs. And what had happened is we had, you might call them typos, but the names were spelled wrong. One of the names, we just simply got an incorrect name from, I don't know where it came from, but that they carved it like we told them to, but the name was misspelled. And the others were names that were spelled wrong or put in the wrong place. And we had to, what we did originally, there were something like 15 names that were had a problem. And we made a mixture of granite and epoxy, filled in the names and recut the names. They used sandblasting to cut the names. But the patch didn't hold. The weather would just eventually, they deteriorated to the point where somebody goes out and looks at a name and it is not perfect. So the board has replaced at least probably 6 or 7 slabs because of that. The last 2 slabs cost $25,000 to replace.
That's inflation, right?
Yeah. We got the whole thing for $175,000, or $190,000. Anyway, since I've been going out with classes, the word's gotten out from, and it's not a big, we're maybe 4 or 5 times a year I will go out with school classes. Some people know, all they have to do is call, and if I'm available, I'll go out and talk to the children about the memorial. And I've developed a routine that I use where I give them, I'll make a sun line with dollar coins, these new gold dollar coins. I always keep some brand new ones around. And I'll give these out as prizes for people who can answer questions like, what's the pointer called? And they have to say Nomen. And I'll tell them it's 10 cubits high.
Okay.
Another question I ask him is, what verse from the Bible, the one that starts out, for everything there is a season, a time to be born, a time to die, ends up a time for war and a time for peace? And so what verse is that? And they have to say Ecclesiastes. And another, the very last question, the toughest one, is that from the tip of the gnomon to the bottom of the face is 1 nanosecond. Can anybody tell me what a nanosecond is? And I've only had one class that had someone that knew what a nanosecond was, which is 1/1,000,000th of the distance that light travels in, the distance light travels in 1/1,000,000th of a second. But anyway, I tried to put in some universal dimensions that would kind of tweak the minds of people. Incidentally, the width of the gnomon, it has a wedge shape at the bottom, is exactly 1 hour on either side of high noon. So that's at the width. The angle is set by the latitude, 38 degrees, 10 minutes, and some few seconds. And if you sight along the spine of the gnomon at night, it points directly to the North Star. The spine of the gnomon is parallel with the Earth's axis, so it rotates in exactly the same plane as the Earth's axis. So anyway, that's just part of doing a sundial. One of the questions, and I do this with high school classes, before they get on the bus or before they leave, I'll say, everything it took to design this, I learned from one teacher at Russell High School, Mary Washington. Plane geometry, solid geometry, and trigonometry. So it's not as hard as it looks. Anyways, I do enjoy going out there with the children in the classes. And it's been I've been out there with other groups. They had a Russian delegation that came. They had a Medal of Honor winner who spent time in a prison camp in Vietnam. incidentally, I flew, went to flight school and flew in the squadron with a man, Render Creighton, who spent 7 years in the Hanoi Hilton. He was one of the first men to be shot down, and shot down in 64 and didn't get out till 71. So anyway, I enjoy going out there, and we just, I guess to wind this thing up, we had a great day yesterday with probably 200 or 300 bikers from Rolling Thunder on their way, on their run for the wall, they call it. And there were hundreds of people out there. And the memorial is still doing its work. And I have a slideshow that tries to explain the function of it. One of the things is, of course, it's a place for people to remember what happened in Vietnam or in that war. It's a place for history. It's for remembering individuals, next of kin. It's a learning place to learn. Learn about history and learn about a little bit of physics too. So it serves several roles in the community. And it's the one, it's my legacy as an architect. I've done much bigger projects, but this is the one that everyone will remember.
Do you feel it's the most important one you've done too?
Yeah. Well, not really.
No.
I've done two retirement communities, and the best one is in Richmond. I'd say at least that ranks up there with the memorial, but it's a place for people who are, it has condominium cottages for independent living. People can, in fact, a small house, they're just row houses all on one floor. Don't have to worry about stairs or anything. The complex also has an assisted living apartment with a full dining room and a commercial kitchen, and they can have their meals, a hot meal every day. And it also has a nursing home in the thing. So once you move into St. Andrews, you can live normally like you're in a house, although even those cottages have communicate with a nurse in the, so that if they have any kind of a problem, they have call buttons in the bathrooms and the bedrooms. But it served its function well. It was done, I decided to, in order to pull all the buildings together, we used a common design features like the slope and color of the roof and the brick color and the trim color and everything. But every cottage is a little bit different from every one. I've actually met with most of the owners that bought the condos, and we've altered each one to fit whatever their special needs are. Some of them wanted skylights, and some wanted screened-in porches, and so forth. So, anyway, I consider that a very I think it serves its purpose well. About half of my practice, it's been planning, and that's something that nobody ever realizes is there. I was the primary design consultant for downtown Lexington's urban renewal project back in the 60s and 70s, early 70s. And I've been an advocate and a crusader for the urban service area, which preserves the horse farms around Lexington. And in the last 25 years, I got into military master planning with a good planner named Bill Qualls, who's passed away now. But we've done, I've been involved in over 40 projects involving military master planning all over the country, as far away as Hawaii and Alaska and Washington State,
Bored.
Do you think your career when you were in the Navy kind of attracted you to that kind of military planning?
No, it's just that I was a planner, and I'd worked a lot with Bill Qualls, and he was the one who went out and got the jobs and everything, and I was just a consultant. But I was the, we'll say, site designer for the for most of the projects. And eventually, when Bill retired, I became his replacement at GRW Engineers. And I kept the job for about 3 years before I retired there. And I retired from there when I was 65. And then went on to do some other work. Did a big apartment project in Nashville since then. 150 units, and I'm trying to think of the big ones. But those are, I've done, I will say, I've probably got about 2,500 apartment units out there on the ground.
Okay.
And I've done site plans for probably double that many, preliminary plans that, for projects that didn't get built. But my primary work has been about half and half, half planning and half apartment, residential, multifamily projects. In the middle range, not not the plush apartments, but for average people. But nobody will ever remember any of those master plans or apartments. They look like every other apartment that you might see. They will remember the memorial. That's how I'm introduced to most people. That's the guy who designed the memorial. And I can live with that.
Yeah. So it's a good thing to be remembered by.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've since entered five other competitions for memorials, but did get an honorable mention in for the Michigan Vietnam Memorial. But I entered the memorial for the World War II Memorial, the Korean Memorial, the Ground Zero Memorial, and the Flight 93 Memorial. And I thought I had winners on every one of them, but didn't work out that way. They just don't know good design when they see one.
Yeah, that's it. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Roberts.
Well, I've enjoyed talking about it. Everybody likes to talk about their work.
Well, it's very interesting. Thank you.
Well, thank you.